All right, it's a little past time for us to begin this morning. If you would, open your Bible to Revelation chapter 20 and prepare to be confused. I say that in a little bit of jest. As we've been studying through, we know that apocalyptic literature is not the easiest to understand. Some of these signs and symbols are a little bit easier than others, but we're coming into a chapter that is used as fertile ground for the premillennialist, and a lot of error is put into this chapter, and so we need to familiarize ourselves with it. There are some things in it that are a little more difficult to grasp than some of the other things we've looked at in Revelation, but we'll go through, study our way through, and then have a time of discussion when we are finished. Again, as we are approaching or going through the book of Revelation, we're doing so with the understanding that we can understand the message of the book of Revelation. We need to remember the style of the book. It's a book of signs and symbols. That would be very evident here in chapter 20. We need to remember why the book was written. It was written to help Christians in the first century who were suffering for their faith. And we're going to talk about this verse in a few moments here, Revelation 1:1. That the bulk of the book is about things that must shortly take place, and it would have affected the lives of these Christians 2,000 years ago. However, in chapter 20, we cross the line and we begin to look at some things that are yet to take place. And when we get to those passages, when we get those verses, we'll talk about that a little bit more. But the bulk of the book addresses things that have already occurred. Here's a breakdown of chapter 20. We see in chapter 19, we saw that the beast and the false prophet, that they were defeated and that they were thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone. Now we get into chapter 20, and we see that the one enemy who remains, that is Satan, we see that he is bound and overthrown. Verses 1 through 3, Satan is bound. After that, of course, the saints reign without that opposition. And then Satan is overthrown, verses 7 through 10, and then we have a scene of final judgment in verses 11 through 15. And so that's the breakdown that we are using here in chapter 20. Verses 1 through 3 are the first main section, talking about the binding of Satan. It says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand." And we're far enough along in the book of Revelation that we're starting to see some of these symbols reappear. We have an angel who has a key. And remember, a key represents authority, the possession of authority, the authority to unlock or the authority to lock and to bind something. So he has authority over the bottomless pit. We've already seen the bottomless pit, that's where the works of Satan come from. The agency of Satan comes from the bottomless pit. And here we see Satan is destined to be bound in the bottomless pit. If we go back, and we're going to try to look at a number of verses in the book of Revelation, outside of chapter 20, and other places in the Bible, in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4, 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4, here Peter speaks of angels. He says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and deliver them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment." So here we see that the angels who have sinned have been cast into a place of confinement. I believe that corresponds to the bottomless pit here. And Satan himself has been bound in this bottomless pit. We see also in verse 1 that this angel had a great chain in his hand. This chain would have been used for binding or restraining. And so the chain represents God's power to bind or restrict Satan. And verse 2 says, "He laid hold of the dragon," that serpent of old, "who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. Now verse 2 corresponds very well with chapter 12 and verse 9. Which identifies Satan as the red dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil. The devil would be the accuser or the slanderer, and Satan, which would be adversary. And so the description here in verse 2 corresponds very well to that of the dragon in chapter 12, and at verse 9. But notice here, bound him, and that's the purpose of the chain and the key to the pit, bound him for 1,000 years. And here we go. You know, premillennialist, premillennium, there in the very name, they look at this 1,000 years, and of course they want to make it literal, and they want to make it something that is yet to happen, that it hasn't happened yet. Well, of course, we know as we've been studying through, we've been focusing on the fact that Revelation is a book of signs and symbols. It's a very symbolic book. And so we're not going to stop right here and make this literal. We understand that this 1,000 years is figurative. It is a multiple of 10. 10 is the number that refers to completeness, 10 fingers, 10 toes. But it is a large number. It's the number 1,000, not the number 10. 1,000 years actually is a contrast, and the purpose of the contrast is to show the fullness or the completeness of the reign of Christ and His saints. If you back up in Revelation to chapter 13 and verse 5, and then we're going to look at chapter 17, verse 10, I want to point out a couple of things about Satan and the beast and the false prophet and the kings that join them. These things have been said already. They've been said leading up to chapter 20. Chapter 13 and at verse 5 says, And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. It's a short, defined time period. 42 months, a short time period. You go to chapter 17 and at verse 10, chapter 17 and at verse 10, this is identifying the harlot who is riding the scarlet beast. It says, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. That's verse 9. Verse 10, there are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. As we've gone through the book of Revelation, we've seen the enemies of God and God's people, they're told that their authority lasts for a short time, or for 42 months, a short time. Contrast that with this number 1,000. And the contrast makes the point. These enemies will appear to prevail, but they're only going to last for a short period of time, while the cause of Christ is going to last an extended period of time, or by contrast, a great and an enormous amount of time. That's what the 1,000 years means. It's not literal. It's not something that can be counted on a calendar. It is contrasting the reign and the authority of the enemies of God's people with the kingdom which shall never be destroyed that Daniel saw in Daniel chapter 2, I believe it's verse 44. So the 1,000 years here corresponds to the reign of Christ. And here, of course, it's talking about the binding of Satan, that he is bound for 1,000 years. Verse 3 says, and he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him. Think about Daniel when he's thrown into the lion's den, right? They put a door on that and they sealed it shut so that he could not get out. But notice here what is said, that the devil is put into this pit, he's shut up, he's sealed up, so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. It doesn't mean that Satan ceases to operate, because he still operates. He still exerts an influence. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 says that our adversary enemy is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. But notice specifically here, God, when Rome fell, God binded Satan, he restricted Satan, so that Satan could no longer deceive entire nations and bring them into his will to accomplish his purpose. Egypt as a nation opposed God's people. Babylon as a nation opposed God's people and purpose. Assyria did the same thing prior to that. Rome was doing that at the time the book of Revelation was written. When Rome fell, there has never been a world power that has arisen that has opposed God and opposed God's people in that way. So when Rome fell, Satan was bound And in the time since then, yes, there have been people that have opposed Christianity, and there have been movements that obviously have opposed Christianity, but not on the scale of a world empire. That came to an end. Satan was bound so that he could no longer deceive the nations and use the nations as a way of trying to destroy God's people on this earth. And notice, this was going to last until the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. It appears, this last sentence in this verse, somewhat difficult, and we've got to step out on the limb of speculation, and I'm not comfortable there any more than you are. But it appears this verse is talking about something that is yet to occur, that at the end of time, Satan is going to be allowed to exercise that control once again. And perhaps some have speculated that the end of this age is going to be similar to the end of the world before Noah's flood. That things are going to get terrible, things are going to get bad on a global scale. Again, that's stepping into the realm of speculation. I'm not comfortable there, but that's the best sense that I can make out of this last sentence. Going on to the next section, but we see here, now here's the big picture. Remember, Revelation is a big picture book. Here's the big picture. Satan is bound. Our enemy is bound. Ultimately, he is going to be bound, he is going to be restricted, and it would have brought comfort to these struggling Christians. The next section, verses 4 through 6, we see the reign of the saints. Verse 4, and I saw thrones. Now here, the Satan, the dragon, has been bound, and so here's the result. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the Word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now again, premillennialists like to look at this as a real, literal event that's going to happen on this earth. And when Jesus comes back, he's going to reign in Jerusalem, and all the saints are going to be with him and are going to reign for 1,000 years. Now, that's not what this passage is talking about. It's not talking about something that is yet to happen. Satan has been bound. He's been bound already. And so this 1,000-year reign, which is symbolic, it's figurative, has already been going on, and it's still going on even today. This reign of the saints with Christ for 1,000 years, I believe, is describing the church age as it exists today. As the gospel is being spread, as the law of Christ is in effect in this world today, I believe that is this 1,000-year reign of Christ with his saints. And again, think about the book. Think of the purpose of the book. These Christians are suffering, but yet they're reigning. They need to understand from a spiritual perspective, they were reigning with Christ. They were not defeated. Christ was not defeated. Verse 5 says, but the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. This is a difficult sentence. The first resurrection as opposed to the second resurrection. What is the first resurrection? Well, notice there's a contrast. We saw in verse 4, there was a contrast between those who were reigning with Christ and those who worshipped the beast and his image and received his mark on their foreheads and their hands. Notice, they're not going to live again until the 1,000 years are finished. That movement is gone. When the beast and the false prophet were overthrown and when Satan was bound, that movement was gone. And so that was the death of that movement. But whenever the beast and false prophet were destroyed, when Rome fell, there was a resurrection. Now, I'll give you two possibilities, and you might want to throw in more. The first resurrection, there are some commentators who say that this first resurrection here is the resurrection of a cause. That is, when Rome fell, it was almost as if Christianity was reborn. The opposition was gone, and now Christianity, the church, was allowed to exist in this world and to grow and to flourish without opposition. That's one view of what this first resurrection is. With Rome gone, Christianity is back. The problem that I have with that is that Christianity didn't go anywhere. Christianity existed during the time of persecution from Rome, and as a matter of fact, that's when it spread, was when it was being persecuted by Rome. Another understanding of the first resurrection is to look at it personally. The first resurrection would be when one becomes a Christian. Before we become a Christian, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1 says that we are dead in our trespasses and in our sins. And Jesus said that if we're going to be in the kingdom, we must be born again. We must be born again. When we are baptized, that man of sin is dead and we bury him. And Romans chapter 6 says that we come forth to walk in newness of life. And I believe that is the best understanding of this first resurrection. When one becomes a Christian, when one becomes a part of the Lord's church, when one becomes a part of that thousand-year reign, the church existing here upon the earth. I believe that's what the first resurrection is. Now, premillennialists will look at this as a literal bodily resurrection. Premillennialists have at least two or three different resurrections that occur. The problem with that is John chapter 5, 28, 29 says there's one resurrection. One resurrection, not many. But the first resurrection, I believe, is spiritual. I believe it's when one becomes a Christian, and that separates him or makes a distinction between him and the one that worships the beast and receives the mark of his name. Verse 6 is another one of the Beatitudes in Revelation. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So notice here, having part in the first resurrection makes one a part of the 1,000-year reign with Christ. And over such a person, the second death has no power. When we get to chapter 14, we'll find out what the second death is. Spoiler, it's hell. That's what the second death is. But if we have part of the first resurrection, spiritually reborn, we are saved, we are Christians, then hell has no power, no claim over us. And instead, as we live and serve Christ as Christians in the church, we are priests of God and of Christ. And we've already seen on verse 4, we're sitting on thrones. So we are kings and we are priests. Verse 7 goes into the next section, and that is talking about Satan being overthrown. That's verses 7 through 10. And it's here that I want us to see where a distinction needs to be made in the book of Revelation. We have focused all through our study that the book of Revelation addresses things that must shortly take place, things that would have happened in the lifetime of those Christians in the first century, or things that would have been put into motion that would have brought an end to their enemy. We know Rome fell a couple of hundred years later, slowly disappeared and dissipated as a world power. I believe here, though, we begin to look further into eternity, and we begin to look towards the end of time. And so we need to make that distinction as we study the book of Revelation. The bulk of it addresses things that would have pertained specifically to the first century Christians, but here at the end of the book, we're looking at things at the end of eternity. I know some brethren don't want to make that distinction. As I'm studying through, I believe that's the best thing to do, because it was written to encourage first century Christians, no doubt, but doesn't it encourage you when you talk about heaven and when you think about where you're going to spend eternity? That's an encouragement to us today. It would have been an encouragement to them as well. And so here at the end of the book, it looks beyond the immediate future and it looks towards the end of time. Verse 7, now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. And that is, again, in that bottomless pit. Now, we saw at the very end of verse 3 that he would be released for a little while. And so we know that this time that Satan is unrestricted, it's just going to last again for a short period of time. That he's released from his prison, and he will go out to deceive the nations. Notice he's going to be allowed to do this again. He's going to be allowed to deceive nations, which are in the four corners of the earth, all over the globe, Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog have been mentioned already in the book of Revelation. They are found in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, where they are identified as the enemies of God's people who try to destroy God's people and bring an end to them. And so they're used here in the book of Revelation not to represent specific two specific nations or peoples, but to represent all nations that would oppose God and would oppose His will. Notice Satan here, he's going to give it one last try. The harlot who was riding the scarlet beast had all her kings under her authority gathered together to fight against the Lamb, and they were overcome. Satan is going to give it one last try. He's going to gather all the worldly forces that he can, going to gather them together to battle, and notice their number is as the sand of the sea. So it sounds just as bad as it did in chapter 19 when the beast and the false prophet were fighting against God's people. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Things looked bad until at the end of verse 9, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. What sense do we make out of this? Well, here John is seeing yet another vision in which all attempts against God to frustrate God's plans to destroy God's people are met with a devastating end and an exact end. Verse 10, the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are. We've already read about them being destroyed, and they were cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. And now Satan is cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. So here, the suffering saints in the first century as well as us today, we know the end of Satan. We know that that it is the lake of fire that has been prepared for the devil and his angels. And we see here in chapter 20, verse 10, that that is where he will end up. And they will be tormented day and night until they are burned up and cease to exist? No. How long is hell going to last? Forever and ever. And we've got brethren today who are trying to teach that hell is annihilation, and that you only suffer for a short time and then cease to exist. That is not what the Bible teaches. And then the last section here in verses 11 through 15. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. A great white throne. Now, John's already seen thrones. The throne scene, chapters 4 and 5, and there have been little thrones, but here's a great throne. It's the big one. And what color is it? White, which represents purity or holiness. There's no doubt who is sitting upon this throne. A great white throne and him who sat on it, from whose face the heaven and the earth fled away. What's going to happen? What's one of the things that's going to happen when Jesus comes back? Okay, the earth and the heavens are going to pass away. This physical universe that God has created is going to come to an end. And the element, again, is fire. 2 Peter chapter 3 and at verse 7. Yes, start at verse 7. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. And so the earth was destroyed once with water. It's going to be destroyed the second time with fire. But this fire is not going to be a purging fire. It's going to be a consuming fire. Verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. The idea here, set forth in Scripture very plainly, is not a purging fire. And that's what our Jehovah's Witness neighbors will teach, that the earth is going to be purified, and unless you're one of the 144,000, heaven is going to be here on a renewed earth. Jehovah's Witnesses teach that. I'm sure there are others in error who teach that, but I want to tell you, the last few months, I've notice some exchanges taking place on Facebook. We've got brethren who are teaching that nonsense now. That heaven is going to be on a renewed earth, that we're not going to go and be in the presence of God in the spiritual realm, but that heaven is here on earth. And again, There are brethren who are teaching that, so you need to be aware of that. That's error. This earth is going to be destroyed. The heavens are going to pass away. I don't know how you can get preserved out of pass away. And burned up, when you throw a log in the fireplace, it's gone. It's not cleansed, it's gone. And that's what's going to happen to this physical earth. When Jesus comes back, everything physical is going to be gone. Something else about this point in verse 11, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. Verse 12, and I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God. If the heaven and the earth pass away, there's nowhere anyone can hide. No one's going to hide from this day of judgment. All of us are going to come and stand before the throne in judgment. Now verse 12 again, let's back up. And I saw the dead, small and great, that's everyone. I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. Well, on this day, we've got books that are open. Now, let's remember again, this is in a book of signs and symbols. A literal book? Literal books? No. The idea of something being written in a book gives us the idea that it is preserved. It's not forgotten. It's there. Does God need to write anything down to remember it? No. Karen and I talked a little bit before class. We need to write things down in order to remember them. And I'm finding that I have to do that more and more. But God doesn't have to do that. So it's used symbolically to impress upon us the fact that God does not forget. God does not forget. Books were open. Well, what are the books? We know what one of them is for sure. It is the book of life, and the book of life contains the identity or the names of those who are saved by God. What are the other books? Some have suggested that they are the laws that God gave under different dispensations. You had a law that was given to the patriarchs. You have a law that was given to Moses. You have the law of Christ. Everyone's going to be there. What dispensation they lived under, that's the law that they're going to be judged by. It appears also that they're judged according to their works by the things that are written in the books. This is worded in such a way you could understand that the books contain a record of our lives, of the things that we have done, the things we have said. The idea, remember, it's a book of signs and symbols to convey a message. What's the message? Everyone's going to be there on judgment, and there aren't going to be any surprises. No one's going to sneak through. Everything's going to be laid open and bare on that judgment day. And that's the message here from verse 12. I don't know that we can satisfy every question that would come from this verse, but I believe we could all grasp the message that is conveyed in this verse. Verse 13, the sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. I believe verse 13 is simply restating verse 12. Everyone's going to be judged. Now, this first phrase in verse 13, the sea gave up the dead who were in it. I know that there are some who take that phrase and they find great comfort in a literal interpretation of that phrase. That is, those who die at sea are buried at sea. And I've actually sat at the table with mothers who have lost their sons in the Navy and they were buried at sea. And they say, I've got great comfort in this verse knowing that at the end, my son is going to be there. He hasn't escaped this, but my son is going to be there. And I don't want to take anyone's comfort away. However, the word sea has already been used a number of times in the book of Revelation, and we pointed out that it is used symbolically. The word sea. Now, if it's a sea of glass before God, that represents the transcendence of God. But the word sea has been used a number of times, and we've pointed out that it refers to society at large, just a sea or a mass of people. And the idea here is all of those who are dead are going to come forth. All those who are dead, anyone who has ever lived, they are going to be there. Death and Hades. Death and Hades are introduced to us in chapter 6. The pale horse that goes forth. Death is there and Hades follows. Death claims the physical life. Hades would take the soul, the immortal soul. Well, here at the end, they're going to give up the dead which are in them. And again, just like in verse 12, they're all judged. All of the dead are judged, each one according to his works. Verse 14, then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. A couple of comments to make about death and Hades being cast in the lake of fire. Again, symbolically referring to the final end of these two things. If it's the end of time and there's no more physical life, then there can be no more physical death. So death no longer exists. But in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 26, the last enemy that will be destroyed is death. And that's the point that Paul is making here, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, talking about the resurrection of the dead. The last enemy that's going to be destroyed is death. What do we see in verse 14? Death is destroyed. Death is cast into the lake of fire. So it's the end of death. It's the end of Hades. They're not needed any longer. There can be no more death. It's the end of the world. And so they're done away with. They've served their purpose and they're done away with. This is the second death. So we mentioned up in verse 3, I think it was. Maybe it was verse 6, one of the previous verses about verse 6 perhaps. About if we're a part of the first resurrection, the second death has no power over us. We said that that's hell fire, and indeed it is. First death is when we die physically, when our spirit is separated from our physical body. The second death is when our immortal soul is separated from God finally and forever. Death is a separation. The second death is when we're separated from God finally and forever. And if we can't be with God in heaven, where does that leave? That leaves the lake of fire. There's only one other place. And so the lake of fire is the second death. And verse 15 makes it even clearer. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. So there's the destiny of one who is not a faithful Christian, one whose name is not written in the book of life. They are cast into the lake of fire where they are tormented with the devil and his angels forever and ever. And so, the Christian who was suffering in the first century can gain some encouragement from this. I don't want to end up there. I don't want to end up in the lake of fire where I'll be tormented forever and ever. I can handle temporary persecution in order to escape the lake of fire. But those who choose to spare their lives are going to lose them in eternity. That's exactly what Jesus meant in Matthew chapter 10 when he talked about that. Or I think it's Matthew chapter 16. Too many I thinks to suit me. So as we get to the end of chapter 20 and get ready to go into chapters 21, 22, here's what we have. Those who have rejected God in favor of the beast and the false prophet will suffer eternal torment in the lake of fire. That's an obvious message that we get from chapter 20. In contrast, the eternal bliss of the faithful is what is reserved for the last two chapters in Revelation, chapters 21 and 22. So I have covered a lot of material. Here we've got a couple of minutes left. That's right. Remember, Revelation is the Bible's picture book. So as we look at that thousand-year reign, we have to contrast it with the reign and the authority of the beast and the false prophet and of the dragon. It's always mentioned as being short and small. And so a thousand years is not literal. It's just blowing the figure out of the water to show the contrast. The kingdom of God will stand. It will not come to an end. Yeah. But neither one of those were a literal resurrection of the dead. One would be the symbolic resurrection of a cause. Now that Rome is out of the way, Christianity can flourish without opposition. And the other is that first resurrection is when we personally become Christians. Neither one of those views looks at a bodily resurrection. That would be the second resurrection, would be a bodily resurrection. That would be the only resurrection. If, you know, to say that it's a first resurrection would mean that there would be another one to follow. And so that first resurrection would have to be something other than a bodily resurrection. Symbolically, it would have to refer to something as if it has come forth from the dead. And that's either Christianity, after Rome is taken out of the way, either it's as if Christianity is made a comeback, or personally, when we become a Christian, spiritually speaking, we're no longer dead, we're made alive in Christ.
Romans 6:5, talking about baptism, it says that for if we've been united together in the likeness of his death, certainly we also shall be in the likeness of his resurrection. This being a book of signs and symbols, this would be something that would be like a resurrection, not an actual resurrection.
That's right. That's right. We've gone over. We need to release the hounds. Chapter 21 on Wednesday. Chapter 22 on Sunday.